Hello, and welcome to Words and Pictures, the show all about the narrative arts scene. I'm S.W. Conser, and today we're roaming the galleries of the Portland Art Museum, talking with the people behind the exhibition Animating Life, the Art, Science, and Wonder of Leica. Animating Life is a show all about the stop-motion artistry behind the films of Leica Entertainment, including Coraline, Paranorman, The Box Trolls, and Kubo and the Two Strings. I'm talking now with Brad Wald. He's the CFO and head of business operations at Leica. Thank you for talking with us in Words and Pictures.
You're so welcome. Pleasure to speak to you.
I know that there have been a lot of activities planned for this exhibition geared towards students.
Yes.
So for more traditional museum patrons, what can they expect to see and find out about and learn about in this particular art exhibition?
Absolutely. We'll have different programs that explore animation itself, having our animators show how stop-motion animation is done, 24 frames in a second. We'll have our puppet makers show inside a puppet with its armature, its skeleton, and all that goes into it. We'll have different talks about our visual effects and how we blend age-old stop-motion with new age technology. So this museum, to me, in my mind, kicks off an amazing journey that we'll have with the Portland Art Museum, and we're going to activate it with many programs, screenings, educational tours, classes, panel discussions. So we're going to be very active. All of my team will be supporting that. But then we hope to take this show on the road.
Brad Wald, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Such a pleasure.
And now we're talking with animator, professor, and media artist Rose Bond, who is the curatorial advisor for the Animating Life exhibit at the Portland Art Museum. Well, Rose, what did you want to spotlight when you were helping curate this exhibit? What did you want to really focus on in bringing out the art? In some ways, it's a bit of an editing job, isn't it?
Yeah, it's this idea of craft and artistry, and that's always a bit dodgy area to get into. It's like, what is craft, what is art, and all that kind of stuff. So I was looking at the idea of the handmade, and I was looking at why Leica, why Portland, not just because Travis was born nearby, but that there is this respect, I think, for the handmade, for DIY, we'll figure it out, we'll do it off pattern, thank you, that I think Leica, in all of its, you know, sort of corporate success, still maintains. And I thought that was an interesting thing to look for as a kind of a thread. Will that be in this show? And being here today and seeing it is like, yeah, it's definitely there. And the conversation I just had with these key people at Leica, just to see how they interact with each other and how interdependent that they are, organic almost in how they're working, just seemed really different from a Hollywood model and really, really a good fit for Portland.
I'm wondering if you're sort of threading the needle between high and low, commercial craft and fine art. Did that enter your mind when you're helping curate what the traditional art museum patron might be looking for and might not be crazy about?
You know, I think we live in this world where definitions are getting very blurry. If you look at what's happening in Japan, there's a line between commercial and art. It's not there. It's not there. And I just think the art world's got to open up, that it will. And I think the commercial world needs to look at broader audiences or more specialized audiences, whatever. The messaging, who's not there? Who keeps being left out? I do think that you have to remember that this is not the first museum showcase for animated work, that Tim Burton had a show at the Museum of Modern Art. So, and that was really well attended. And don't think that Brian, the head of this museum, didn't note and read those stats on that. So the public is interested in not just this sort of Western classic canon of art, but I think the public is interested in the art in Italian design cars or motorcycles or animation.
Rosemond, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Conch. Keep it up.
So now I'm talking with Nelson Lowry. He's the production designer at Leica. And Nelson, why don't you tell our listeners what all of that entails?
I'm one of the designers of the films, and that means I actually work with the director in designing the look and feel of the film.
So you have a lot to do with the sets, with the environment, with the neighborhoods and landscapes that the characters move around in.
Yes, with everything. I mean, the characters in the costumes often come first, but then I build the sort of world around them. And that can mean vehicles, the woods, houses, caves, just kind of every potential environment that the story might take you to.
One of the really standout features of the film Paranorman was that practically all of the buildings and streets, cars, features were all asymmetrical. They didn't mirror left to right. They had a skew to them, and it sort of added that off-kilter feel to the film.
Yeah, that sort of asymmetrical design was something that Chris Butler, the director, wanted, and it was of course the shops didn't initially love it because there wasn't a single straight line in the film, but it was so fun to design that. I got to take the director out to the East Coast, and we walked around. And I'm telling you, some of those old neighborhoods, they are kind of like that. I mean, the old architecture and things that were built early on all had a weird slant and a lean to them. So, you know, because Norman wasn't a normal kid, and he lived in this kind of crazy world, we wanted the look and feel of the world around him to reflect that.
In the Box Trolls, the whole environment, it has just impossible geography, impossible architecture, all sort of hanging by a thread, almost waiting to fall over. Putting that environment together, was that fun? Was it aggravating? I mean, what was involved in trying to make something clearly absurd look believable?
Box Trolls, that was extremely difficult. You know, when you do what's called a napkin sketch at the beginning of a project, and that's just jotting down some sort of lyrical kind of line quality, you often have to clean that up and make it less crazy so that you can actually build it. Well, that didn't happen on Box Trolls. We stayed with that. Paul Lassane, who was the production designer of that film, worked with a couple of amazing artists, and they really pushed that aesthetic into every single set and prop. And it was a very challenging show to build because of it. But if anybody does get a chance to come by and see the show here at Portland Art Museum, there's a few sets. One of them is sort of a grand hall that there's a dance sequence in. And you'll see the impossible, not a straight line, not a flat surface, and then the patterns and colors and specular put on top of them. It made for just absolutely spectacular sets, that aesthetic.
How did you fall into this job? You say you made things all your life. What led you to this place?
Well, it goes back quite a ways. But, my mom was a miniaturist, and my dad built some dioramas for museums. He was also an industrial designer. Mom was an illustrator. I went to art school. I immediately, getting out of art college, went to New York and worked in theater and did commercials. I am an obsessive builder, and that turned into designer, but I still make things. It's my happiest place I go to. I still come home after, a 10-hour day and go into my studio and make things myself. So it's a lifelong passion.
Nelson Lowry, it's been great to talk with you today.
You as well, and I encourage anybody who can get down to the Portland Art Museum to come check it out, because it's one thing to see the film, another one to stand inches away and see these beautiful costumes and props and characters.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Konser, and I'm here at the Portland Art Museum, where the exhibition Animating Life, the Art, Science, and Wonder of Leica is underway. All right, now I'm with Rich Garrity. He is the president for Stratasys, which manufactures the 3D printers that turn out all of the puppets for these features. And Rich, help us demystify the term RP, or rapid prototyping. This is a version of 3D printing that's used in the animation industry. And really, how does it work?
Yeah, so prototyping allows any designer, any engineer, to take an idea, turn it into a computer-aided design file, take that file, and essentially print it, and turn that design or idea that they have in their head into something that's real, that's tangible, that's physical. So rapid prototyping with 3D printing is really about fast iteration. So have an idea, get it printed, get a sense for what it feels like, looks like, tests, and so forth. Go back, you may tweak the idea a little bit because you don't like something in a particular feature. It's a simple tweak on the computer file. You print again, you've got a new update in your hands in a matter of hours. And so what it does is it greatly compresses the cycle of how you go from idea to creation. Whereas traditional means of making things over the years, there's many steps and many hours involved with getting something made. 3D printing allows you to have something right next to you and be able to iterate product design overnight. Leica is a great example of that. We started working with Leica 10 years ago, but it was really Kubo and the two strings that took the partnership to a whole new level. They've come to us and said, look, this is the type of intricacy, the fine feature detail, the level of colors that we need to achieve to make the films appear much more lifelike. And so 3D printing allows Leica to be able to do this seamlessly, really cut down on the time it takes to get the puppets, and allows them to get a level of intricacy and detail that you just can't achieve with any traditional manufacturing method.
Rich Garrity, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Well, I'm here now with Brian McLean, the Director of Rapid Prototyping at Leica. And Brian, so you are responsible for taking these concept drawings. Sometimes you have character designers who are working with pencil and paper, or more likely graphics tablets. And you have to translate that into 3D character models. What is the process like with that?
That's a great question. And the way that we go about that is we actually will first, there's an interim step where a character design goes from 2D to being 3D, and it's first sculpted in clay. So we have a very talented group of sculptors who will take these character designs, translate them into a three-dimensional object. And this is the first time that the crew has really seen how this character is going to look in 3D. The rapid prototyping department will take that sculpt, which is called a maquette, and we will scan that with 3D scanners, and we will bring that into the computer, and then we will rebuild the head to ready to be animated. So it's called retopologizing, where we'll actually be building out this maquette, and we'll give it a mesh that we wrap over the face that we'll then later be able to animate and turn and break into a puppet. The maquette is also then given to the puppet department, and they start using that as their blueprint to figure out how they're going to build the rest of the body of the puppet.
So you started out working in clay yourself when you were a lot younger, and rapid prototyping, so switching out faces and facial expressions, doesn't have quite that metamorphosis potential that clay does. But are you trying to, in the technology you're doing these days, are you trying to get back to more of that transformational quality that clay has?
Yeah, the amazing thing about replacement animation is the sky's the limit as far as what you can do with a performance. With the computers and the way that we're able to, you know, control subtlety, you can have a character that has amazingly subtle and fine movements, And then you can have that same character go into an extreme facial expression, or even morph from one face to another, or one character to another. So replacement animation has the benefit of really being able to do anything that you can do in clay.
Brian McLean, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're listening to a special episode of Words and Pictures, all about the art of Leica entertainment. I'm SW Conser, here at the Portland Art Museum, where the exhibition Animating Life is underway. Now I'm talking with Steve Emerson. He's the visual effects supervisor at Leica. Welcome to Words and Pictures, Steve.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your department and what people can see at the exhibition that shows off the whole range of visual effects.
Well, stop motion animation, if you haven't already gotten the idea, it is a precarious art. You know, we will create shots and animate performances that sometimes they take days, weeks, months. And over the course of realizing those performances, inevitably things are going to go wrong. And so part of the responsibilities of the visual effects department is we come in and we clean up the mess afterwards. The flip side of that is we're very much about enabling storytellers. So, the art of stop motion animation, it can be very limited in terms of the types of stories you can tell. So if you look at a lot of these classic films, you don't see a lot of characters, you don't see many environments, you don't see costume changes, you don't see big, Hollywood style effects. So if you're a storyteller that's looking to tell a specific story or make a film using stop motion animation, oftentimes you're asked to simplify. Kind of the idea with Leica is we wanted to stop that. We love stop motion animation, but we didn't want to make any type of concessions with the stories that we wanted to tell. And we were going to get there by introducing technology into the mix. But at the same time, we wanted to make sure that if we were bringing technology into a stop motion world, that we were doing so in a way that is ultimately respectful of and honors the art form. So in terms of this exhibition here, some of the things that you could see that we're certainly very, very much involved in. When you walk into the foyer and you see the hollow bone skeleton, which is the largest stop motion puppet that's ever been created, and no other studio on earth would be insane enough to take that thing on. Right? That thing, you can imagine, it gets out on the stages, they're building scaffolding. And it's got all kinds of rigging and wires, and you have an animator that is like physically climbing all over this thing, working as hard as he or she possibly could to hopefully get a second of animation out of it a week. Believe me, when those shots dropped, there was a lot of problems and a lot of things that we had to clean up. So just have a look at that skeleton and imagine what it took to bring to life, and imagine what it probably looked like when it came over to visual effects to do the additional digital touch-up work.
It sounds like one of the things that you're trying to do with visual effects is really expand the landscape.
Sure. For me, when I go to the movies, I want to be told a great story. I want it to be executed really, really well. I also want to be able to connect with the characters. I want to be able to empathize with those characters. I want to experience what I'm seeing and believe what I'm seeing. And a lot of that is achieved through strong visual effects, through great lighting. And again, when you're talking about, classic stop motion films, you can certainly be swept up in the story, but I guess what we're really trying to do here is to take audiences to a place where they are experiencing the world of those characters, they are connecting with those characters, and ultimately, hopefully, being moved emotionally by those performances. So a lot of it is it's not only about being respectful of the art, but also driving a realism into it that will hopefully bring people into the story and let them forget that they're experiencing something that, it's not real. It's being done one frame at a time. And somebody out in a warehouse in Hillsborough built it with a hammer and some wood, a bunch of nails and some paint.
Steve Emerson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the exhibition. And for everybody else out there, please come check it out. It is so cool.
So I'm talking with Georgina Haynes. She's the head of puppet fabrication at Leica. And there's a great deal of full puppets and partial puppets and all sorts of puppetry here at this Animating Life exhibition.
There is indeed. You know, we're so proud that we are putting together the largest exhibition of our work from over the last sort of 12 years of making the feature films we've been making in Portland, in Oregon, our sort of hometown. We have taken from Coraline, from Paranorman, from Box Trolls, and from Kubo and the Two Strings, and we're trying to show the highlights of our art form. Of course, my department is the puppet department, and I've been lucky enough to be with the department since its conception. And, you know, what's amazing is that I work with an incredible team, around about 80, 85 artists and craftspeople. And it's not just one person beavering away making a puppet. It's a team of people that come together collaboratively. It's designers, it's mechanical engineers, it's jewelers. We have people who make miniature hair. Some of them come from hairdressing, full-size hairdressing. Some of them come from model making. So we pull from all of these different skill sets. And, you know, when an artist comes into my department, they will come with a skill. Maybe it's not a puppet making skill, but then we will help sort of nurture that skill into the world that we're involved in, this small scale, intricate world. So, you know, what's great is we're trying to give people a glimpse behind the scenes of how that's done and things that are half made, so you can see through the sort of the shiny surfaces to what the guts of a puppet are, you know, what the skeleton is, what's going on underneath it. How does a stop motion puppet work?
Apart from the parts of the puppet that you can see, the facial expressions, the costumes, the props, the hair, there's also underneath the things you can't see, in particular, the structure called an armature. And if you were to look at it without the puppet skin on it, it might look like a miniature version of the Terminator.
You know, that's very well described. So I started as an armature maker in stop motion. I loved all aspects of it, but I just fell into armature making. And they are essentially the skeleton of a puppet. But the skeleton of a puppet is not like a human skeleton, because it has to hold the puppet in place frame by frame. So every joint that is in the articulated sort of framework of that armature has to have enough tension in it to hold it in place against skin, against costume, you know. And the armature makers, along with, I would say, the mold makers and the casters of a puppet, are the unsung heroes, because you don't see their work, and yet it's so important to the performance of the puppet. You know, stop motion has been around for 100 years, and even 100 years ago, they were making armatures for stop motion puppets based on ball and socket joints, hinge joints, you know. But we've taken sort of that initial information and then also combined it with technology, which allows us to perfect the art form of muscle movement and oh, this character's got wings. How are we going to make these wings move? So, yeah, the armatures are an amazing structure, which is almost, I always liken it to a Swiss watchmaker. Our armature makers are like Swiss watchmakers. They're making these tiny sort of jewelry-inspired skeletal forms that help propel those puppets and bring them to life and help the animators bring them to life.
I remember when the first feature from Leica came out, Coraline, there were people you had on staff who were master knitters, who were making miniature custom sweaters and other sort of togs.
You know, it's so interesting. We look back at those days, and the big thing on Coraline was the fact that we used a miniature knitter. And, you know, she didn't work in Portland. We found her. She was mother of, I think, triplets. And so she had her own world. But she had this incredible talent, this art form of taking almost thread-sized needles and making these miniature knitted jumpers and sweaters. The interesting thing is that was like early foundations of us building our costume department. And now what they do in the costume department is, you know, they've taken miniature pattern making. They actually make their own fabrics now. So before we were just doing miniature standardized knitting. Now we're making our own knitwear out of silk threads, and we're using different ways in which to make our costumes so that they're in style to the film. You know, if you do something traditional like just taking a real life sweater and miniaturizing it down, sometimes it won't always hit the design lines of the film. So we're looking more at the sort of the whole look and design concept as part of the costume making. So yeah, we're making so many different fabrics, embellished fabrics, knitwear, but not through the conventional way. Yeah, so it was a starting point.
Now, what was the path that led you to this position of head of puppet fabrication? What sort of fun detours along the way brought you to this point?
You know, my path has been fun. I was the kid that was an academic. My doodles in the back of my textbook were way more impressive than my math or my English. But I had this love and this understanding of art and craft. I just made things. My mum poured a big pile of fabrics in the middle of the living room floor when I was 4 years old and went, my daughter's never going to be bored. Make something. And I made a real big mess and I made some art. And my dad was like, oh no, my house is never going to be tidy. But I was very lucky. My parents encouraged me to follow my own path. So when I was at school and academia wasn't for me, they said, but you're a great artist. Do your art. So I pursued an artistic path all the way through school, through college. And then at the same time, I collected old Victorian dolls. I wanted to make my own dolls, but I was in a very fine art-based college. And my lecturers, they were great, but they did not understand me making dolls. They were like, no, you're too talented an artist just to make dolls. So the puppet thing came out of that, me trying to get around my really cool art lecturers, but trying to make them understand, no, these could be really interesting. So I actually started studying the history of puppetry and how I could interpret that with my skill set. Started making puppets, hand puppets, string puppets, rod puppets, and then found this crazy world of animation. Was lucky enough to get an apprenticeship at a company called Cosgrove Hall, which was famous for Wind in the Willows and lots of other kids' stop motion TV series. And basically my talents grew out of that.
Georgina Haynes, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And enjoy the exhibition. It's open until May and everybody should come and see it. It explains all about stop motion, the wizardry of stop motion animation.
You've been listening to a special episode of Words and Pictures here in the galleries of the Portland Art Museum, where the exhibition Animating Life is underway. Thanks to our guests today, Brad Wald, Georgina Haynes, Steve Emerson, Nelson Lowry, Rich Garrity, Brian McLean, and Rose Bond. The audio for this show, as well as our extended interviews, can be found on our archive page, kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And you can keep up with us on Twitter, @wordsandpicture.